Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday, the 4th of September, 12 minutes past 9 o'clock. Very nice to have you, to be in your company on this morning, and it is very nice to be able to introduce our panelists to you, and then we'll talk. You will listen for a little bit, and then maybe something will scratch an itch. Maybe something will create an itch, and you will want to tell us about it, or you will want to ask about it, or you will want to inquire about something, and then you are engaged in the program. Panel at WAMC.org, and you'll be able to send us an email and tell us all about it, and hopefully we can make the itching subside. We have a great group this morning. Let me introduce them to you, and we're great. We have a full house today, which is very, very nice. We welcome investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman, this morning. Hello, Mark. How are you?
Morning, Joe. I'm a little forlorn about the last few days of summer, but I'm getting over it.
Yeah, yeah, it's because yesterday it was beautiful, and then it gets a little chilly at night, which is fine, and then you know we know we're rolling into fall, right? Yeah,
well, yeah, fall. Look, fall around here, I don't mind.
No, it's a beautiful season.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
For better or worse, the winters are getting ever more tolerable.
Yeah, well, exactly. We welcome Nick Rangel to the program, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Hello, Nick. How are you?
Hello. I'm doing great. I will say my very furry German Shepherds love this weather right now and have found a renewed sense of youth because they can wrestle much longer in these temperatures.
How many do you have?
Just the two.
Two. Yeah. And I was at a stoplight where there were two lanes, and in the car next to me there were two German Shepherds with their heads out. And they were the most beautiful dogs I've ever seen. They were a brown and a black, like a deep brown and a black coloring to the German Shepherds, and we hung out and talked for a little bit. It was great. They're very, very sweet dogs.
Did they have a lot to say? Because they are usually pretty talkative.
This particular, they just seem to be enjoying the air.
Yes, yeah. It is exactly it.
Yeah,
we accidentally took a 6-mile hike this weekend, and by accidentally I mean we went much further than we anticipated.
Was that the dog's fault or your fault?
It was my fault.
Yeah, okay, all right. But they didn't hold it against you.
And then they came back, we're like, oh, they're gonna be totally pooped after this. They were not.
No.
They could have kept going.
They're great dogs. We had a German Shepherd when I was a kid. It was the first dog I had when I was a kid, and his name was Schultz. And what is the name of your German Shepherds?
My 2-year-old is Sevro. She's named after a character in the Red Rising series.
Yeah.
If you're familiar, it's a great series. And the other is Kala. It's the word for the color black and the goddess of death.
Perfect. Yes. Perfect. Well, they're great.
She's black. She's a solid black.
With like great a tiny dogs. White. God, splash. They're beautiful. Just beautiful, beautiful dogs. We have Judy Patrick with us, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, former Vice President, a longtime editor at the Daily Gazette in Schenectady. And it's a pleasure to have Judy with us. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning. We had a German Shepherd, and his name was Fang.
Fang. Oh, that's great. Oh, like a soupy sales character. That's great. And lived for a long time?
He could have lived longer.
Yeah. Yeah. Our German Shepherd, when I was a kid, I was born, we got the dog, and then dog lived to be 16. So I had like the first 16 years of my life.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was great. It was really, really great. We have a newbie with us. We have a brand new panelist. We are thrilled. She comes to us from upon recommendation of our dear friend Anna Markowitz, who said, "You have to have Ashley on the show." And we said, "Well, damn it, we're going to have Ashley on the show." Ulster County Board of Elections Commissioner Ashley Didis Torres. And Ashley, it is an absolute delight to have you on the show, and we welcome you with open arms. Thank you very much for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I hope Anna doesn't regret this recommendation.
I doubt that. We love Anna. We love having you here. It's wonderful. So how are I don't even know how to say this with a straight face. So how are things going as a County Board of Election commissioner?
They always have to go. There is an election day. It is happening no matter what. But things are interesting. They're getting relatively political as we get ready for next year's midterms and, of course, this year's local elections.
The headlines are filled with stories about things that affect what you do, maybe not in the county or in the state, but certainly in general, of people going to exercise their right to vote. And when and I know I heard you say this before, we went on that there was a confab of commissioners from the state that got together. So what do you all talk about when you get together?
Sure. So we have every year we have a conference. It was last week in Lake Placid. So all election commissioners, their deputies, their support staff, we got together in Lake Placid. Mm-hmm. And when we get together, we talk about a gamut of things, logistical considerations. We use a lot of technology in the work that we do, so we speak about those aspects. But then we're also speaking about outside factors that are affecting us, national topics, the presence of ICE in our communities, how to dispel dis and misinformation for our voters, getting out there, talking to the public. There are commissioners and boards of elections in all 62 counties in the state, so we are the front lines of democracy. We're on the ground. It is a bipartisan setup, so there's Democratic commissioners and Republican commissioners in every county. So we have our unique set of challenges depending on what political hat that we wear. But when we get together, it's also a lot of lamenting and storytelling. What are you dealing with your inspectors? We hear a lot of similar issues. We laugh and we cry together because we're in it. We're all in it. And we have a lot more in common than we don't. It's great to get together like that.
And the tears or the joy can come not just on around election day. I mean throughout the cycle,
yeah,
right?
Throughout the cycle.
I'm fascinated when we hear stories like the president doesn't want to have absentee ballots or mail-in ballots and wants to do away with machines. How do you react? I'm not putting you on a political spot here,
sure,
but just like of how you react to that of say, okay, well, what do we need to do if we have to be ready for that?
Yeah, so after my eyes roll to the back of my head and I have that moment of, oh, my, what now? Oh, my God. I do go to that space where I'm like, all right, well, how are we going to message this back out to our voters? What is the truth? What are the facts? How do you register? How do you keep everything from devolving into chaos? So doing things like I am today, being out there, doing media events, going out and talking to groups of people. In Ulster County, we have a lot of community outreach that we do. That is a big part of my job, going out and talking to folks in all different spaces. We do programs like our sticker contest, which went viral a couple years ago.
Yeah.
So we go out to schools, we talk to kids, we have coloring books for children that we also think help educate their adult parents. So that's helpful. We go out and we speak with vulnerable groups, different communities. And so that's where I go to, really trying to hit people where they are so that they don't come looking for us. We come looking for them. I'm trying to get as much information in all the spaces where people find it. Our website, I'll do my plug right now, voteulster.com. It is funny enough, we get hits from all over the country because our sticker went viral, that when you look up Board of Elections, you often find our local Ulster County is only 144,000 registered voters. I get calls from all over the place. And so we try to, of course, we have our local rules and our state rules, but it does help people from all over the country. I get calls from Minnesota, Illinois, all over the place, Pennsylvania.
So Election Day 2025 takes place. Do we have a primary before a general, or is the primary's over?
Primary's over. That was back in June. All right. So the general election is November 4th, and early voting in New York will start on October 25th.
Okay. But as it stands now, still machines?
Still machines.
And we are able to use paper ballots.
Yes.
I mean, absentee ballots.
Yes, absentee mail-in ballots. We have both types in New York State. So we have vote early by mail, and we have the absentee ballot, both that you can apply for online. And we have our early voting, and of course we have our election day voting. And our machines that we use, and all the machines in New York State, are paper-based, so that we can do hand counts and audits. Paper balloting, where you actually fill out the ballot, in my opinion, is the best way and really the only verifiable way of conducting an election. And New York has set that standard. So we are ahead of a lot of states that are using interfaces that are tablet, where you are touching the screen. We don't do that here. So
let me ask one more question to you, and then I'll bother the other panelists. But that is, do you sense any, if I'm making this up, I don't mean to. I'm just asking because I'm curious. But do you notice, or do your spidey senses tell you that the national and international news, especially the national news about voting and changes in voting and proposals in voting, will in any way suppress the vote that you would normally see, even though there are no appreciable differences in how people will vote in November?
Yeah, so my senses are that it will definitely affect people. We have seen how executive orders, different directives that are coming out of the White House are affecting people's mindset in voting. Earlier in the summer, we got a lot of phone calls from women wanting to know, do I need to bring my birth certificate? Because I heard that if I change my last name when I get married, if it doesn't match my driver's license or my passport, I'm going to get stopped from registering or going to vote. So that we saw an effect for that. That's just here in New York. But I also am worried and concerned for states that are, because it is a state-based, these rules are state-based, that these directives are a green flag that Trump is sending to those states. In red states, you should stop voting by mail. You should look at your voting machines. It's going to ultimately hurt Republican-led states if they're going to go ahead and make those changes. Because when you get rid of voting by mail, which is a completely verifiable way of casting a ballot, it will depress turnout. And is it going to depress turnout in blue states? I don't think so. I think it'll hurt his own base, which it's confounds me that that is something that is being out there. I think that they'll do it to appease him, and that would ultimately hurt their own, all of their voters. It doesn't matter if they're Democrat, Republican, Independent, or otherwise.
You've been commissioner for how long?
I've been commissioner since 2017, but I've been with the board since 2010, so this will be my 15th general election.
And how many, and in that time, how many cases of fraud have you had to deal with?
Two.
Okay. No. Oh. All right. do your own math. It is an absolute pleasure to have you here, Ashley.
Thank you
very much.
Me.
Welcome to the program, and we look forward to hearing you throughout the proceedings. So let's go on and talk to our group this morning about the issues making news, and we welcome you, the home listener, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Big story coming out of Harvard yesterday, actually more out of the courts than from Harvard, but it certainly impacted them. Harvard University won a crucial legal victory in its clash with the Trump administration on Wednesday. This from the New York Times. A federal judge said that the government had broken the law by freezing billions of dollars in research funds in the name of stamping out anti-Semitism. The ruling may not be the final word on the matter, but the decision by Judge Allison Burroughs of the U.S. District Court in Boston was an interim rebuff of the Trump administration's campaign to remake elite higher education by force. Harvard's case centered on its research funding, and the university contended that the administration had compromised its First Amendment and due process rights when it sought to strip it away. The judge's decision could give Harvard new leverage in its settlement talks with the White House. Mark Whitman, we'll begin with you.
Well, I was very happy to see the ruling, but I think we have to temper our enthusiasm around it. And I do think it'll be interesting to see how this plays out between here and the Supreme Court. The judge, I actually looked at the ruling. It wasn't written in blood, although it could have been. It was so harsh against the government's case. I mean, the judge was pretty blunt. If this would have been something in person, you might have had to restrain her physically from finishing off her opponent. She said this was the Trump administration assertion that they were doing this under the guise of combating anti-Semitism was nothing but a smokescreen. This really was a First Amendment case in many ways, and therefore belonged before her court, not other courts, as the government had claimed that dealt with strict contracts. But there's an opening here. The judge did say that there was a related Supreme Court case that she looked to for precedent, and it was the decision was so unclear she couldn't find her way to applying it effectively. And the risk here is that when this case goes to the conservatives on the Supreme Court, otherwise called the History Imaginarium, they may find a way to protect more of what the administration's trying to do than one would think is reasonable. I do think as a result of that, it's very likely that Harvard and the government are going to get down to brass tacks and look at negotiating this out and see if they can avoid the risk that each side faces before they actually see a decision from the Supreme Court. I'd also say, though, that in terms of Brown, and there's another institution that settled early, Columbia, they don't look so great in light. That decision doesn't look so great in light of how strongly worded this decision against the government was in Harvard's favor. I think it's pretty clear, and I think on this panel, at least the one I was on, most of the folks claim that Columbia particularly was making a mistake, and this decision makes that clear, at least for the interim. But I do, again, highlight the risk at the Supreme Court.
So one of the things that I was thinking as I was reading this story, actually, let me hold because I see that we have a perfect opportunity to take a break. So let's take a break. When we come back, we will reestablish and we'll go to the other members of our panel. We'll be back after this news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion on this Thursday morning, 34 minutes past 3 o'clock. No, 9 o'clock. 34 minutes past 9 o'clock. Wouldn't you be excited? Well, we have been talking for the last few minutes about a judge ruling that the Trump administration illegally canceled Harvard's funding. Mark Whitman was talking about that right before the break. What I was going to bring up, and then I want to hear from the other panelists, because Mark alluded to this, of wondering what impact this would have, as I believe the article mentioned as well. The first thing that came to my mind is, from everything that we have heard, the White House and Harvard are working on a settlement, and I do wonder what impact, if any, this would have on a settlement. Because my understanding of those talks was that they were fragile. And I just didn't know if this would push it in one direction or another.
Well, I can tell you, if both sides thought this decision from the lower court was imminent, they would have shut down the talks. And both basically had decided they were willing to cast their lot and let this decision then affect the trajectory. I would think now there's more incentive on both sides to settle here and not face the vagaries of the Supreme Court. And I also think there's reason to be hopeful that there'll be a settlement in the following sense. The government and Harvard, the government sends a lot of money Harvard's way, and the government can take all sorts of formal and informal steps to monitor, for instance, how much of fixed costs Harvard is allocating to certain contracts. So there seems to me enough fungibility in the exchange of funds between the two enterprises that there be a way to Harvard to say, well, we're going to, quote unquote, pay you X, allow the administration to declare victory and retreat, so long as what Harvard's being asked to do in terms of the language of the settlement isn't unduly onerous to Harvard. And if you look back at even the Columbia settlement, it was pretty vague. So you would assume that Harvard's got a stronger hand, and there might well be a way through here that avoids putting this before the Supreme Court. I just think these parties are going to deal with each other on an ongoing basis in lots of meaningful ways, particularly in terms of money, such that even if a court decides there's an answer, it's not the final answer because of the ongoing exchanges between the two.
Judy.
You know, if you've been watching this story or following this story all summer, you would have thought that they were very, very close to an agreement.
Right.
I mean, people were all up in arms. Oh, Harvard's going to settle. That doesn't appear to have been the case. I think they may have won this battle, but I don't know if they're going to win the war. And I almost think the administration will go to the mat with this. They'll go all the way to the Supreme Court because they believe that the Supreme Court will uphold their position. The other thing Harvard has to deal with is, you know, we may resolve this year's funding or the current funding, but they want to get grants next year and the year after, and that's what is their incentive to come up with a strategy that will give them a settlement going forward. And I think the administration knows that. You know, it's but as Columbia has shown, you know, settling doesn't necessarily get you those grants next year. This is going to be an ongoing fight for the next 3.5 years. Or longer.
Nick?
Yeah, I do think that the demands from the federal government of Harvard went beyond their demands of Columbia in that they wanted to have like an intimate relationship with who was hired, what was taught, the specific curriculum in the classroom, and like beyond just whether or not Harvard was adequately addressing the student activity on campus, but also how it would serve its students going forward with appointments from this administration within the administration of Harvard, right? So, like, I think what's at risk for Harvard goes beyond addressing the students that participated in lawful protests. And it also goes beyond the fine the federal administration is wishing to leverage on and charge Harvard with, but these other concessions that Harvard seems far more interested in protecting itself from in this battle.
Yeah, so to that point, the anti-Semitism as the red herring as the parts of this settlement that jumped out to me. Of course, the judge acknowledged that Harvard could do more on campus to combat this issue, but school just started for colleges a few weeks ago. I think that these things are naturally going to pop up again, whether that's Gaza or other issues. And using political ideology to remove funding is potentially going to be something that others that campuses are going to have to deal with. I mean, these are life-saving grants. The research that's being done is critical. It's not just for the Harvard community, but it benefits all of us, especially right now when we'll probably talk about this later, but public health research is on shaky ground. And so I think it's definitely something to watch. I see where you're both coming from. I could see it going to the Supreme Court, but I also think that there is incentive to settle as well. So it's an interesting topic.
What's hard to really measure is the impact on every other university and college in the country that's looking at this and retrenching and, you know, being careful and really cutting back on the grants they apply for, or really spending a lot of time making sure those grants are bulletproof, or, you know, getting rid of their DEI programs. And it's almost impossible to measure, but it's definitely happening.
Well, I mean, in the world of grants, we are already being required to sign new kinds of terms and conditions attached to funding that we've had for years. And I think while the case with Harvard has frozen funds and unfrozen funds and then refrozen funds, and this battle is going on, by the time they get to a renewal grant application or a new grant application, the federal administration will have had enough time to revise the requirements of the grant application, the types of research it's willing to fund. There is a real step back from certain kinds of public health research because this administration just doesn't value the kind of scientific evaluation of certain types of care or treatment that exists and has existed forever.
Right.
And then all of the schools and all of the rest of the organizations that rely on federal grants are going to have to either change the work they're actually doing with the money, agree to terms and conditions that maybe are not mission aligned or at odds with their actual mission. So we are seeing language, for example, that in terms and conditions that prohibit the use of certain of federal funds in that grant to advance gender ideology, right? Like these like initiatives by this administration that there are organizations whose whole purpose is to support transgender folks. So how do they sign that contract? So there are those conversations are happening, and this case is going to eventually just lead Harvard to have to decide whether or not they can even take those grants in the future, and other schools, right?
Yeah, and well, and the other thing you're seeing is researchers going to other countries. You know, England's a better place to go. You know, it's not just the National Institute of Health, the National Science Foundation, all these, you know, upper level institutions that have been the backbone of funding, you know, important, you know, theoretical research that we can't even understand. That money's going away, and all these brilliant minds are nervous and looking elsewhere to see where they can take their, you know, their microscopes and their test tubes and, and their chalkboards
and other accoutrements.
There's also this push at the federal level for grant funding to that prohibits the use of federal grant funding to advance the concept or the argument that certain public health risks are the result of some systemic or social issue. So, like, if the social work school is researching the ways in which there are social impacts or social determinants of domestic violence, right, where there's like a systemic or social or public reason that's impacting that rate of intimate partner violence, federal funds can't be used to advance that perspective or viewpoint or advocacy anymore under these like new terms. And I find that like really fascinating on like an academic level.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have letters, and we welcome yours. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Our panel discussion is underway, and we thank you very much for being with us on this Thursday morning. Mm-hmm. That Monday holiday is still messing me up as to what day of the week it is. But we thank you very much for being here, and we appreciate you being a part of the program. We go to, Dan writes, I'm dying to know what the two voter fraud cases centered around that came up during the introductions. Off topic, but circling back would ease my curiosity and make it much easier to sleep tonight.
Sure. The one issue that we had a voter who was voting by absentee ballot. And we get records when someone passes away, our deceased records. So we got a ballot back after the voter had passed away after discovering that their husband had been signing their ballot envelope for them. So that was one issue. The other issue ultimately was not a voter fraud issue, but it was something that came up at a poll. Say a voter thought that another voter signed in for them. Their names are almost exactly the same, and it was just a point of misidentity. So those are the two that we had to research, go involve law enforcement. So that's what we do. When those things pop up every so often, we reach out to law enforcement. We use the tools in the toolbox. If we think it rises to the level, we send it over to our district attorney. And that's how it works.
All right. Hopefully that answers that question. We go to this letter from Lisa, who writes, "This is extortion, plain and simple, a mob administration." And then we got this from Doug, who says, "The six conservative members of the U.S. Supreme Court have effectively rewritten the Constitution unilaterally to make the current president a king. In many cases, they are putting off making final decisions so they can pull back those powers the moment a Democrat becomes president." Anyone want to weigh in on that? Hearing none, we move on to other topics.
Well, Joe, I'm trying to hold back.
Oh, you had your chance. Yeah. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I can still go?
Of course.
Look, I don't like the decision on presidential immunity. But we have yet to really see what its effect is in practice. And if you listen to those like Bill Barr, he doesn't think it's much of a change from where we are before. Of course, we weren't going to criminally prosecute the president of the United States if he did something within his powers, even if he made a lousy call. But there are others like Alan Dershowitz who thought the president had amazing latitude even before this decision, and those that fear that the decision we're talking about gave the president that latitude. But we actually haven't seen any cases yet that hinge on that. Although I should hasten to add, just like the threats against the other academic institutions, obviously the anticipation that the court may afford the president more latitude leads to a broadly chilling effect, and that's what we're seeing here. We can talk about this a little later in the show. I don't agree that this is extortion, but I do think it is very clear that we are facing a sort of 1930s type slip into authoritarianism. I think it's global, and I think the topics we're talking about today are emblematic of that.
There are elements and ingredients of extortion in here, though, right?
I guess, but they're withholding money in order to get Harvard to come to heel. They're using extortion, I guess, as the tool, but that's not the objective, right, is to dampen the authority of the institutions within the nation that serve as a counterbalance to the slide into authoritarianism.
Hey, back in the old days when the federal government wanted to change something, like if they believed there was anti-Semitism at a college or university, the Justice Department would go in and there would be like this negotiation back and forth. And there wouldn't be the sudden termination of, a threat to the utter existence of the university that, like the Trump is doing. It seems like it was a much more measured approach to how they were negotiating that back and forth. A much more, I don't know, maybe bureaucratic or a much more, systematic approach rather than, and I think this, I'm going to take away all your funding is more of a thuggish approach.
I would also, I caution against using language that isn't quite aligned with the facts. It's not extortion if it's not actually the school's money to begin with. It's actually the federal government's money that it issues through a grant process. Like the federal government isn't obligated to continue funding a school or their particular research or any organization, right? Like they're, in this case, the school was awarded through a process, and withholding that funding has been determined to be illegal, but in the future, if the school doesn't get that money anymore because it doesn't come to heel, that's not extortion. That's a federal administration. That's just fundamentally differently differently prioritizing how they spend its money,
right.
Which we know it wants to spend less money on these kind of projects. This is just one.
Right. The motive can still be
for
there.
Cutting that funding. Yeah. Right. Like I think they would find any excuse, and they will continue to find other kinds of excuses for cutting grant funds to these kind of programs across the board. They don't need an excuse. They just need to pass a budget. Right. Like, but everybody is going to see a reduction in grants to these kinds of initiatives.
It's a great point. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Hey, here's exciting news. House Republicans have formed a new subcommittee, and they're probing January 6th. House Republicans voted on Wednesday to establish a new subcommittee to reinvestigate the January 6th, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol, moving to reopen one of the most polarizing chapters in American politics. Lawmakers slipped a resolution into a rule on the House floor that would establish the subcommittee, which is likely to be headed by Representative Barry Loudermilk of Georgia, a Republican. Republicans have complained that the original probe, which was led by Democrats, was biased against President Donald Trump, who had repeatedly denied he lost the 2020 election to Joe Biden. Loudermilk has already helmed one inquiry into January 6th. He used a subcommittee of the House Administration Committee to conduct a follow-up to the Democratic-led investigation after Republicans retook control of the House in 2023. Loudermilk said in a quote, "We're going to continue the work that we did last time, which is looking at the evidence to still try to understand how did the Capitol get breached? There was a huge security failure here." Democrats said they weren't aware the resolution had been added to the rule until it was debated in the House Rules Committee on Tuesday night. Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland, a Democrat, a member of the first committee that investigated the attacks in the Capitol, said in a statement, quote, "We welcome yet another chance to remind Americans of House Republicans' ongoing complicity with and embarrassing apologetics for MAGA's violent insurrection against Congress and Vice President Mike Pence and Trump's sinister attempt to overthrow a presidential election." Sleeping dogs lie?
You know, this is the follow-up on that old rub against Nancy Pelosi, that she didn't do enough to safeguard the Capitol that day. I think that was the only thing the Republicans who supported the insurrection had in the early hours of the insurrection. You know, and this follows. Now they're talking about giving the January 6th rioters compensation. It's not enough that you give Ashley Babbitt full military honors for her funeral and give them, most of them, pardons. Now we're going to give them money for their, you know, compensate them for the, apparently the trauma they went through. I agree with Raskin. Bring it on. If you remember, the Republicans made a fatal mistake on that first go around where they decided they weren't going to participate in the in these hearings, and so you didn't have that voice. Let's hope the Democrats don't make the same mistake. I hope, you know, that they're there asking the same kind of pointed questions. The problem is that this is a Republican-led investigation. You know, the idea about how many people were actually at the Capitol guarding, you know, how many police officers were there, whether or not the National Guard should have been there in full force. I mean, what kind of indications there were that there was going to be violence that day at the Capitol. I mean, indeed, there was some. I can remember reporters gearing up and saying what they had to do in case things went awry. But that typically always happens. And remember, Donald Trump said, you know, meet you at the Capitol, we'll be wild. So there was some indication that something was going to happen. You know, let's talk about it. I don't have a problem. I wish Congress would spend more time on their budget and working on health care and immigration. But if this floats their boats, go to town.
Nick?
I mean, we're obviously still trying to distract from the Epstein file situation. It's just silly. But
aren't we relitigating something that they already won, essentially?
Well, I think what's going to be interesting is 1,500 convictions have been brought by attorneys for the government against individuals who participated in that attempted overthrow of the federal government and violent attack on the nation's capital. 1,500. That's a tremendous amount of evidence that's been already collected by the government's attorneys across the country for those 1,000 guilty plea outs and 500 actual convictions. And so I just don't know what the commission is, how it's going to benefit the Republicans now that the government's own attorneys have collected even more evidence, have pulled together even more statements, have had these years to pull together the strongest cases against the folks who have these convictions, right? I mean, like, bringing that forward just doesn't seem strategically helpful to people trying to make the case that January 6th was just like a fun day in the park, right?
Yeah.
I just don't know how they do that.
Ashley?
I agree with you, Joe. I don't know why we're going here again. They won this issue when they won last year's election. The voters reelected Donald Trump in a fair and free election. He won the popular vote. With this looming, the Democrats were talking about the January 6th event all throughout the election. Although are we trying to just erode our institutions more? I mean, of course, that day was to certify election results. So, of course, I agree. It's a distraction, but it's a concerted distraction to relitigate that election. Are we going to start talking about, did he really win in 2020? Is that where we're going with this? If so, then that's is this what congressional Republicans are going to want to talk about all next year instead of forward-thinking policies, how we're going to help average Americans pay the bills, the economy? Is this what Speaker Mike Johnson wants to give to his caucus to bring home and talk about? I think it's a miscalculation. I don't really understand why this is happening. They won. You're right. They won. It's time to move on.
I actually, when I heard Raskin's comments, I understand what he's doing, but I think he's smarter than that. I think he knows what they're doing. They're trying to buttress the cognitive dissidence of the loyal mega base and even stoke fervor in amongst those who are still up for it with respect to 9/11. And also they're playing to Trump and helping to feed his claims that he really did want win. I think you have to put yourself in the Orwellian terms of the Republicans who are catering to this core base that they have. Also, I think you have to realize that the January 6th Commission changed very few minds in this country, as we talk about, not enough to sway the election. And so because of that, there is still a reservoir of the MAGA believers who can be, again, re-energized with this. And I think that's what the Republicans are going to do. And you can hear it now. You could hear all the nonsense from the podcasters and the channels that are favorable to the administration in terms of blaming Pelosi and the rest of it. So I think we've danced around it, why they're doing this. But I really do think there's a reason. I think they do think it'll serve their purposes. I think Raskin even knows it. But that's not a soundbite you can talk about in 30 seconds for the New York Times. So he says, let's bring it on. But I think he understands the dangers.
We will take a break. We'll hold it there. And we welcome your letters on this subject and others. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue the conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. Joining us to make up this wonderful panel, we welcome investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman, executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, former vice president of editorial development at the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, Judy Patrick. And for the first time on this program, certainly, I hope, will not be the last, Ulster County Board of Elections Commissioner Ashley Dittes-Torres. Thank you very much for all being with us. So we, before the break, we're talking about the House Republicans forming this new subcommittee to probe January 6th. Does anyone want to say anything else before we move on to a new topic?
Just that Mike Johnson really doesn't want to put up that plaque honoring the officers who defended the Capitol that day. Man, they've got the plaque. It's ready to go. And he just is fighting that every inch of the way. I think this is all just, I agree with Mark, that, you know, they're just trying to satisfy Donald Trump, who still wants the world to say he won the 2020 election.
Indeed. All right. Let's go to a new topic. And we, again, welcome you as always. So, let's talk about vaccines. This is always a good one to talk about to get the email rolling in. Let's see. So I'm going to put merge two stories together. The first from the New York Times, which states that snubbing RFK Jr. states announced plans to coordinate on vaccines. California, Oregon, and Washington said they would work together to review scientific data, saying the CDC could no longer be trusted. Three Democratic-controlled West Coast states announced plans on Wednesday to form a health alliance that would review scientific data and make vaccine recommendations for their residents, saying that the federal agency responsible for issuing such guidance for the country has become a political tool that increasingly peddles ideology instead of science. The move, which comes at a time of unparalleled turmoil at the agency, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, is an effort by California, Oregon, and Washington to take scientific stewardship into their own hands after Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a vaccine skeptic, has taken control of the CDC's vaccine decisions. Other states, including several in the Northeast, are considering joining in a similar effort. But wait, friends, there is more. This from the Washington Post. Florida announced yesterday that their Surgeon General, Joseph Ladapo, criticized school vaccine mandates and is moving to end all school vaccine mandates. It would be the first state in the United States to do so. He announced plans to end all the vaccine mandates, including for children to attend school, which would make it the first to completely withdraw from a practice credited with boosting vaccination rates and controlling the spread of infectious diseases. Speaking at a news conference outside Tampa with the governor, Ron DeSantis, Surgeon General Joseph Ladapo said that every vaccine mandate, quote, is wrong and drips with disdain and slavery, and called the rollback the right thing to do. Ladapo's stances on vaccines and other measures intended to protect Floridians have drawn criticism from public health experts and advocates. Who am I as a man standing here now to tell you what you should put in your body? Ladapo said. DeSantis, who at the news conference endorsed Ladapo's measures, acknowledged ending certain vaccine requirements, quote, would require changes from the legislature.
You know who he is? He's the chief medical officer in the state of Florida. That's why he should be able to do this, and that's why he should be doing this. This is entirely, entirely shameful. Children will get sick. This, you know, there have been times in the evolution of public health in which the government has to step in. Quarantines. You have to fight disease. This whole libertarian trend of that is part of the MAGA movement is destructive to public health. You know, I understand the people say, "Oh, I don't want to get my kid vaccinated. Big Pharma. If I hear Big Pharma one more time, I'm going to throw up. This is a conspiracy theory that has very serious public health consequences. You know, it's not just your kids that are involved. It's the kids who can't get the shots because they have some immunosuppressant or they're immunocompromised in a way, or they're very young and they haven't been vaccinated yet. The anti-vaccine movement was, you know, there was always some of that back in the 70s and 80s, maybe early 90s, but it has accelerated because politicians have found that it's an effective conspiracy theory to juice up their support. So I certainly hope that I applaud the states for making this taking these steps, but I am really worried that this is going to have a long-term impact on people's ability to get vaccines. I mean, we're already seeing it now in New York, where it's difficult to get the new COVID shot. I don't even know if I'm going to be able to get it, and I should be eligible. So, these are real world consequences.
One of the things that, and I don't mean this to be classist or I don't know what else it could be, but you know, when you look at some of the stance of RFK and you think, well, you look at his background, and that is not a medical background that he has in making this. The Surgeon General of Florida, Joe Lodapo, who questioned COVID-19 measures from the very beginning, was against vaccines, was against masks, is against gender-affirming care and counseling for transgender and non-binary minors. This is a guy who immigrated to the U.S. from Nigeria. He earned an M.D. and a Ph.D. in health policy from Harvard University, served as a professor of medicine at New York University before being tenured at the University of California. The guy's got creds. And so it just further, I think, is interesting to hear this divide when you consider several states in our country that have decided that the federal government has left them out to dry, and it's up to them to pick it up and to try to do something to save children and adults from hideous disease, while others, even with those with a strong scientific background, have said this, as he put it yesterday, is akin to slavery.
Yeah, Joe, I look at this whole imbroglio in two parts. In terms of the mandates and the absence of mandates, I looked it up yesterday, and listeners can correct me if I'm wrong. But if your child's immunized, assuming they're not immunocompromised, their odds of being protected are well into the 90s with respect to all these. So we're talking about illness and potentially and likely death for the unimmunized. But those of the rest of us, if you will, can protect ourselves. So the harm there is a harm to others. In terms of those who are immune compromised. But the harm there is relatively limited. Where I take exception to what Kennedy and the Trump administration are doing, and I don't think the states can make up for it, is when they're cutting, for instance, research for mRNA vaccines, or they're banning thimerosal in vaccinations. Steps like that are going to harm not only this country, but the world, because nobody can substitute the amount of fiscal backing, the amount of fiscal backing for these endeavors that the United States government can put forth. So to me, those are the real villains. And the other thing I'd say is I've thought a lot about, well, why the heck is Trump? Why is he on the wrong side of this? And it's an interesting case because if you remember back to the Project Warp Speed, he actually, you could call him a vaccine advocate, and he was until he got booed in front of his own supporters time and time again. And unlike the Jeffrey Epstein case, and I think I know why, he was happy to switch sides and just feed his base what they wanted to hear. And then he went and appointed Kennedy for all the reasons we've talked about before. And the sad thing about Kennedy, right, and you talk about the duality of this gentleman,
Surgeon General.
Surgeon General in Florida, about being a well-qualified person making really lousy decisions, and his rhetoric sounds even as bad as his decisions. You know, Kennedy, the Make America Healthy Again part of taking reasonable steps to combat chronic illness all seem very reasonable. And the sad thing is that effort would cut across a number of different departments within the government, including the Ag Department and Education responsible for feeding children. So you can't enact that. And the sad thing is that he can very easily sort of spread this vaccine skepticism that by his own sister's diagnosis is really about something he's done to forward his career politically, as opposed to a firmly held belief on his part, at least if you believe his own sister. So I think the Florida thing is sad, but it's limited in its scope. I'm glad to hear states are doing what they can to offset these steps. But unfortunately, I think they are no substitute for the fact that the government has gone awry and is no longer putting its financial wherewithal and its ability to muster research behind some technologies that will benefit the United States and the world. And eventually these things will come to fruition, but more slowly than they would have if we didn't have people making really bad decisions for really questionable reasons.
Ashley?
Yeah. When I look at this, I look at the West Coast Health Alliance. I think that we'll have something on the East Coast similar. Are we going to start having two separate trains of thought? Are we going to, obviously we are politicizing health and we're going to have West Coast Health Alliance, a Northeast Health Alliance. We do need a national health standard. This is where research happens. This is how we got the vaccine. And also, by the way, COVID vaccines are not required by any school district. It's other vaccines, measles, other, it is not the COVID-19 vaccine. So I look at what's happened with abortion access, going after providers in New York State. We have a provider in Ulster County who is now protected by the Shield Law. And my county clerk, acting county clerk, Taylor Brock, is now being sued by the state of Texas for using that Shield Law. Is this where we are going with vaccine protections? Are we going to start to have red states pass laws that prohibit providers from giving this care? And are we going to have to continue down this pathway of having two sets of standards, blue state standards, red state standards? This makes everybody unhealthy. I think about poor kids in Florida who are not going to have access to vaccines. I think about the teachers, the support staff that work in these schools. This is going to make us all sicker. Disease does not care what party you're in, and we are fastly approaching the highest peak of our season with flu, COVID. All of it is just very scary and deeply sad, and the slavery comment is just wild to me. It's so disrespectful and disgusting.
Nick?
Yeah. So COVID positivity rates right now are over 11%. Like, we are seeing a real surge in COVID in the moment, as well as flu. And I disagree that this is not that big of a deal. I think what we're seeing is actually convergence of policy agendas coming together. We know that the reconciliation bill will diminish the ability of people to have access to Medicaid and health coverage. We know that there's an intention to dismantle aspects of the Affordable Health Care Act, the ACA, Obamacare. We know that we're dismantling the ability of states to pass laws that would force insurance carriers and providers to cover certain kinds of care. And in Florida, if there is not, in any state, if there's not a mandate that care is provided through a healthcare provider, those insurance companies are less likely and probably unlikely to actually cover that care. We also know that men and people in low-income areas and people in rural and remote areas have a harder time accessing healthcare or have some stigma around accessing healthcare. And then you remove the requirement that kids be vaccinated to go to school. And this does not just affect kids. It affects all of the people those kids come in contact with. I don't have kids, but I come in contact with a lot of kids. And if I have some immunocompromised condition, I'm a senior, I have cancer, I have some other condition, I have a disease, I have severe asthma, I then become at risk of being impacted by kids who are not being vaccinated to go to school. And without that mandate, fewer kids will get vaccinated, even if they are not by default in a household that doesn't believe in vaccines. What that does is it impacts the herd immunity rate across the community. You need to have 80 to 95% of a community immunized in order to prevent widespread outbreaks. If you aren't vaccinating kids to go to school, their parents aren't getting vaccinated, the community is less likely to be vaccinated because they don't have access through health insurance, because health insurance doesn't have to cover these vaccines, right? Like, it is actually fundamentally transforming what disease control looks like in this country. And I think we should be a lot more concerned and upset and
alarmed
at this shift at the hands of a person who, by the way, supports an abortion ban after a month from conception. That's before you've missed a period, right? Like, that's before you even have an indication in your own body that you might be pregnant. And then sued advocates for trying to inform the public of what that law would do to people's access to health. So who am I to say what you can put in your body? Clearly, you're a person who thinks you can say what your body is required to do if it has conceived, right? Like, it's just wild. I'm gonna repeat, Ashley, it's wild.
Yeah, and speaking about wild, let's remember that this month in September, we're expecting results of his autism study, which may very well, dramatically impact what kind of vaccines the companies will be able to administer and what kind of conclusions off the chart that it will make, and will affect care, will affect diagnosis. We are just in a very bad place, and Congress needs to step up and do something about it. Recall them.
You may remember I mentioned that nothing like this subject will bring in letters quite like it, but that seems to be true, so I will read a few of them before we go to a break at the bottom of the hour. Robert from New Marlborough, Massachusetts, says the impending disaster may be that the next time the CDC issues an urgent, legitimate health warning, that we won't believe it, because why should we? Jonathan from Northampton, I hear Florida is working on making red lights optional as well. Bill says Florida's decision to eliminate a vaccine mandate for school children is another way to endanger them in schools, along with gun violence. JD from Pattersonville, I went this week to get my COVID vaccine at my regular pharmacy and was told I now need a prescription from my doctor. For the record, I passed the age of 65 nearly a decade ago. Then we go to John. So it's pretty clear that MAHA, Make American Healthy Again, is really MPGA, Make Polio Great Again. Time to invest in iron lungs, says John. Then we go to two quick letters here that are off the topic of vaccines, but go back to earlier points that we were making regarding colleges and voter fraud. First, the colleges. Although the ruling came down about Harvard is in their favor, the all-encompassing issue of giving all students, no matter the level of education, the ability to be exposed to a wide range of thoughts is disturbing. Will we have the ability to have people as yourselves be able to discuss being able to bring in different views? I'm so glad I had the opportunity to take advantage of free thinking, but it saddens me for the generation now up and coming. And finally, we go to this letter from Barker, who says, how long does it take to clarify a question of a potential voter fraud when one would be received?
How long does it take? Well,
I assume depends is the answer.
It depends. Yeah, exactly. It depends. As soon as we find out about an issue, there's steps that we take. There's protocols. We research the voter records. We look at the signature verification files. And then, obviously, when you have to bring in law enforcement and the DA's office, that can take a little bit. If it goes to court, if it goes to case, those things can take a long time. But on the subject of voter fraud, These things are very rare. I like to say it's like getting struck by lightning twice, having voter fraud. But it's the delusion of the vote. Does it dilute the outcome of the election? Yeah. It does not. These are rare instances where it's one voter. It does not dilute the outcome of the results.
We're going to take a quick break looking at the docket. We have more cool stories. We'll get right back to them. I don't know if I mentioned this. I think I did, but the music is from Darling's Side that we're playing this morning. Playlist is posted online, wamc.org/roundtable. You can see the complete playlist there. Welcome back to our discussion. We're going to move on to new topics as we have about 20 minutes with each other still, and some interesting topics to discuss and add to the pile here. So, this was a story, admittedly, I was going to get to yesterday and didn't, but it's still very much with us and is being dissected. And that is, in a ruling aimed at restoring competition in the search engine market, U.S. District Judge Ahmed Mehta refrained from ordering Google to sell off Chrome, the world's most popular browser, but ordered the tech company to end exclusive deals that make Google the default search engine on phones and other devices. The company will not, however, be barred from paying device makers to preload its products, including its search engine and its Gemini AI chatbot. Meta called on the $2 trillion company to share some of its search data, specifically certain search index and user interaction data, though not advertising data, with third parties, and called for the establishment of a technological oversight committee to monitor the company's compliance with the ordered measures for 6 years. This reporting from National Public Radio. The Department of Justice filed an antitrust suit against Google in 2020, arguing that it had used exclusive statements. Check. It had used exclusive agreements with device makers like Apple and Samsung to give Google's search engine a prime position on phones or computers, unfairly boxing out its competitors. In returns, companies like Apple received billions in payments from Google. So a lot there, although there's a lot more as well to discuss on this particular subject. We'll start with Mark Whitman.
Joe, we talked about this decision a while back, and I think I said that I didn't expect the judge to ask for a breakup because the rise of AI as an alternative to classic search engines has begun. And that is very common in U.S. antitrust. Frankly, our legal process is so slow that oftentimes by the time we catch up with technological providers who have in some way enjoyed monopolistic power, usually the marketplace is changing already such that the legal remedies have to be less draconian than they would otherwise be. And the classic example of that, I think I mentioned last time around, was breaking up AT&T at the same time that MCI at the time, if you remember them, and others were nipping at the heels of the carrier. The other reason it is speculated that this judge did not require the breakup of the company, which would have been the sale of Chrome, was that Apple makes a tremendous amount of money from this arrangement. It was in the tens of billions of dollars. And just to get into the details a little bit, whereas their margin on iPhones is 30%, call it, or 35%. So for each dollar with an iPhone they sell, they take 35% roughly to the bottom line. On search engine fees, they take over 80% of that dollar to the bottom line. So it is hard to imagine, given the changing technological landscape, and given the fact that sometimes we could argue politics affects legal decisions, that a judge could have disadvantaged both Google and Apple to the tune of billions, if not, well, billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars in valuation, and had that decision stand up through appeal all the way to the Supreme Court. So I think this is a ruling that will get advocates a little, leave them a little disappointed, but I think it's well within the realms of what's expected. And I think as technology evolves, the consumer will end up being protected by the competition presented by the new AI alternatives. When you want to ask, you know, riddle me this, my phone, people are now ever more turning to the AI options on their phone, whereas before they only used to turn to search engines.
Well, it sounds like I've listened to a couple of podcasts about the Gen AI tools that are out there, and it sounds like Gemini is not competing at the same level as some of the other tools. And so there's some argument that, or I guess the judge perspective, that the competition in the Gen AI world will level the playing field for Google on its own.
You know, the idea here is that the ruling will allow some upstart AI search engines some capacity to get a footing in the field. But, you know, just can I say how much I hate AI search engines or search capabilities, even Google's. It's always in my face. It's always wrong. If you want to really search well, use your own brain and try different search engines, because they go to common sites. It's often wrong. It's just not where it needs to be yet. In my opinion, I just am not a strong believer in AI as a search engine or generating content, finding out the truth of anything. It's just, you know, garbage in, garbage out.
I heard a great comment somebody said the other day that AI is just like a banker. They give you an immediate, definitive answer that's very often wrong. I actually, Judy, I think they're an incredible tool. I think if people aren't using them, they should be. But I think they're no different than any of these other information sources that we use. I mean, you could go back and use the Dewey Decimal System and pull a book off the shelf if you're researching, you know, for instance, vaccines, right? But if you end up with JFK's book in your hand, you're going to get lousy answers. So I think you always have to use your own basic understanding and skepticism to approach the information you get from any source.
I saw my 8-year-old grandson devolve into tears because he was trying to get Google to tell him who invented Roblox or something like that. And it wasn't giving him the answer. I do not understand. And he was used to Google answering his question, and it did not. And so that was a very bad moment for him.
It's not hard to sometimes stymie the AI and the Google machine.
Yeah, and Google's also had those issues too with mimicking back bad information and people's bias, just like AI. I mean, you can fix the settings to change AI to give you more of a rounded answer, but it's still it's newer technology than search engines. It's going to get there, and it's going to get there a lot faster than search engines did. I mean, you see the stock prices of Google and Apple shot up with this decision.
What, 8%?
Yeah, about 8%, and they're not. This is a win for them.
And I'm going to say that I'll ask this somewhat sarcastically, Mark, but I'm really not being all that sarcastic. But what isn't a win for them? I don't know.
Oh, if Google had been forced to divest itself of Chrome, that was the reason the stock prices went up was because the marketplace was afraid there was an outside chance that that would be demanded. By the way, it would have more likely than not just led to an inordinate number of appeals, continued uncertainty. I don't think in the end, I don't think even the market thinks in the very last analysis, Google would have been forced to sell it. But that period of uncertainty would have been expensive. By the way, Judy, you mentioned Roblox. Joe, at some point on this show, I mean, the when we talk about technology and the interface between people and kids, I think this whole thing around the dimensions of Roblox and you know, the fact that there was a guy who allegedly plays Catch a Predator who's now allegedly been banned by Roblox for doing that, and the issues around the tech issues around that and children and games, it's just a story that's rife with intrigue, and the many dimensions of it are amazing, frankly.
So I'm not familiar with what is Roblox?
Oh, Roblox is probably the most, amongst kids, I'm going to sort of 10 to 15, it's probably the most popular platform. And when I say gaming platform, and when I say platform, that's because you go on to Roblox and then you can play various games that other developers have programmed using the visual interface is very basic. It looks a lot like Minecraft, if you will. But the number of games is almost innumerable, and some of them are extraordinarily popular. But, of course, the game faces all these issues around protecting the kids, not only the privacy of their information, but the attempts of people to curry favor with kids and then try to communicate with them offline and then in real life. And there are all sorts of issues that have gone on. And Roblox is an interesting case because it is a public company. And so the rules around its disclosure are therefore heightened, and we're seeing more than we might in other cases of certainly controversial and, I would argue, concerning behavior on behalf of not only those who are involved in the game, but also in terms of the moderator of the game, potentially.
At grandma camp, we spent a fair amount of time trying to get the kids off Roblox. I can tell you that. I had to hide those tablets.
You know, when you first said that, in my aging brain, I thought to myself, oh, good for Judy's grandson looking at like why a roadblock is set up on Route 40.
No.
Alas, no, that isn't what it was, dummy.
More nefarious than that, Joe.
This is a topic near and dear to me. I have an 18-month-old, and the screen time and online. I would love to be a part of that discussion because this is what, of course, voter fraud keeps me off at night, but so does going on with the kids and the internet behavior, and we protect them in the outside world probably too much, but it's the online world, the internet world, that is causing a lot of mental health issues. And it's a generation. There's a great book, The Anxiety Generation. I read that. It gave me a lot of anxiety. But this is an emerging issue, and they have. The government's going to have to regulate it at some point.
And you hear these things that seem unbelievable. And I mean, they're believable. Everything's believable, I guess, because weird things happen. But you have this young kid who's 16 years old who is asking AI to help him with his homework and then starts talking about his mental state and then is suddenly planning his suicide, mm-hmm. which he completed. I mean, that is we got to figure this stuff out, right? I mean, it's just because I mean that says a lot, but it also says about our reliance of even for young people, their reliance and their belief in the information that they're being given.
Yeah, and I think, Joe, there's a real the interface with information has become incredibly sophisticated. And I can think back in my day, it was, well, how do you get a hold of the Anarchist's Handbook Guide or whatever that book was? But that didn't have nearly the ability to interact, interface, and to attract the reader in the way that AI does. And it is clear that we have let social media broadly, including AI companies, conduct an experiment on our children and profit from our children without proper guidelines. We have not figured out how, and they haven't taken adequate steps to help us manage how effective that interface is and how dangerous it is. As to the particular case, I've heard of it broadly. You know, obviously I'm not trying to assign blame, but I do think generally across society, we've blown it in terms of the access that we've allowed these people to have, these organizations to have, to our children and to profit off them without proper safeguards.
And agreed 100%. And also, It's just there. It's not like it's anything that you have to, you're interacting with it, whether you realize you're interacting with it or not sometimes. And I think that is not only problematic, but also very scary. Let's take a quick break. We'll be back. We'll finish up our conversation for this Thursday morning, and we'll do so with our wonderful panel. Last call for your questions, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. I'm Joe Donahue, and we welcome your letters. Last call, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. I just have one more topic that I want to get to, but before we do that, you wanted to make some I believe you said draw a through line, which I like.
Yeah, I. Joe, I came across an interview with Ray Dalio, who's one of these billionaire hedge fund guys, and his hedge fund is based on what they call macro trading. So he looks at macro trends in the economy and tries to profit from them, and he's done very well to the billions. And I saw something from him recently in the Financial Times. I know that's hard probably for a lot of listeners to get a hold of, but if you know somebody who has it or you are in your local library, I'd recommend it. He talked about the infirmities in the U.S. economy with all the debt that we've accumulated, the deficit that we're running, and the increase in interest rates. But his deepest warning was political, where he argues that the times we face now look very much like the 1930s, that interwar period where there were yawning gaps in wealth and in values, crumbling trust in institutions, and divisions between peoples around the world, frankly, in democracies around the world that are so entrenched they can't be reconciled through the democratic process. And in such times, you know, people often yearn for strong men, and that really is what we're seeing. And that same spirit, if you think about it, was on display in Trump's recent cabinet meeting with all those comments of sycophancy from his folks. And layered on top of this is that broader rise that we're sort of talking about indirectly today of what sort of the Orwellian nationalism. And remember, nationalism for Orwell wasn't about patriotism or geography necessarily, but about in-groups and believers, and about sort of refusing everything else, all the evidence that you see that contravenes your own views of the world. And I think that's a very and you can think about that and the rise of populism on the left and on the right around the world, and talk about the dangers that we face on top of this looming financial crisis that we face. I also think it's a very effective diagnosis, not only because it's global, but because it speaks to the burden the Democrats have to stop it with trying to defeat Donald Trump, and talking about the forces that are engendering this nationalism and this populism on either side. The Democrats have been, in a way, effective at chopping off sort of the far left part of their party by and large. You know, Mondani maybe sneaks through, but that's a different case. But I do think it crystallizes what the challenge is for the midterms and for the Democrats broadly.
Big challenges.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think you got to point your efforts at the right target, and I don't think Donald Trump is the target. I think Donald Trump got it right last time round. He talked to these insecurities, these economic insecurities, this gap in values, and he put himself in that breach, and the Republicans have been riding it. And I think the Democrats spent an inordinate amount of time trying to head Donald Trump off at the pass as opposed to effectively addressing some of the other issues. And again, I don't mean to put blame on the Democrats, but rather help them diagnose what the problem is. And also, I think this explains what you're seeing in New York City with Mondani and the rest of it.
Real quick, we got a letter from Kevin who says, Joe, I too thought Judy's grandson was thinking about being a civil engineer in a few years. So there's that.
I wish.
We go to our final topic, which brings us to that New York mayoral race. So Trump advisors have discussed a job for Eric Adams if he quits the mayor's race. The conversations have also involved finding a place for Curtis Sliwa, with the goal of giving Andrew Cuomo a better chance of defeating Zoran Mamdani in November. Advisors to President Trump have discussed the possibility of giving Eric Adams a position in the administration as a way to clear the field in November's mayoral election and damage the chances of the Democratic frontrunner, Zoran Mamdani, according to three people with knowledge of the discussions. The talks have also involved finding a possible place in the administration for the Republican candidate, Curtis Sliwa. The goal, the people said, would be to give former Governor Andrew Cuomo a better chance in defeating Mamdani, the Democratic nominee, in November's general election. Regardless, though, going to be on the ballot, right?
Going to be on the ballot. All of them will be. It's too late to come off. Ballots are certified next week. Absentee ballots go out starting the 19th. Too late to come off the ballot. So all of them running will not be Zoran Mamdani. He will be the next mayor of New York City. The polling shows that. And also everything we know about New York City politics and the history of elections also shows that if he does take this job and ceases his campaign, his name will be on the ballot. People will still vote for him, even though he is not running anymore. And this is this to me is an interesting how involved the Republicans are in trying to help defeat Mamdani when they it is a boon to them for fundraising, creating a boogeyman out of Mamdani, just like how they did when AOC first won, and they still continue to do that to her. But as far as Mamdani is concerned, he will win. He will be the next mayor. And by giving him this much attention, they are making him a national figure, for better or worse. I mean, I think this is it's a gift to him. He is looking forward, thinking and saying, hey, you're trying to get me out of this race. You're trying to subvert the will of New York City voters. I want to look forward. I want to help the affordability of New York City. That was his pivot when this news came out yesterday. That's his messaging to his very large and growing platform. He has more TikTok and Instagram followers than either Andrew Cuomo or Eric Adams by tenfold. So this is a gift to him in a lot of ways as well.
The other thing I can't quite understand about this, Judy, and we just have about a minute left, but Mamdani already beat Cuomo. And so even if you factor in votes that would come from Adams or Sliwa, it was a very crowded field of Democratic candidates, and they slugged it out, and Mamdani won. I don't understand, especially with polls looking at Mamdani being 19 points ahead in the Siena poll. That seems very hard to overcome.
It does indeed, and I looked at this news yesterday and thought, would this help? I think it would help Mamdani if it actually happened. I mean, I think that would encourage more people to get out. So if anything, his election would be even more secured.
We're going to hold it there. My thanks to everybody for being a part of the program this morning. Thank you for listening, and thank you for if you wrote us a letter or shared a thought. We certainly appreciate that as well. Big thanks to our group, Nick Rangel, Mark Whitman, Judy Patrick, and Ashley. What a delight to have you on the program. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
you'll
Joe.
Come back.
If you'll have me.
Well, absolutely we'll have you. We'll set dates soon.
Okay.
Thank you very much. A delight to have you on the program. We'll be back right after this.